From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines in our region this week. Today, our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, Kelsey Mosley-Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Alex Duggan, investigative reporter with KTVB in Boise. Happy Friday, everyone.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
So, Alex, I want to start with you. This is in regards to new develops in the Michael Vaughn case. We did just hear a report on Boise State Public Radio. But first, for folks who have not maybe been following this case, can you give us a refresher on Michael Vaughn, what happened, and then these latest developments?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Michael Vaughn, he is now 6 years old, but when he disappeared, he was 5 years old. He disappeared July 27th of 2021, somewhere in the range of 6 and 7 p.m. He was actually playing his video game that night in the living room. His father went to go change his sister's diaper and put her down, ordered a pizza. When he came out, Michael was gone from the living room. So he looked around, looked in the street, didn't see anything, called his wife and said, is there any place that Michael could be hiding? And, you know, Brandy, Michael's mother, said, well, did you check under the bed? Did you check here? And when she raced home, they both looked for him and figured out that he was gone. So they called the police. And then massive, massive searches ensued after that. And now, you know, there have been steady developments throughout the year about his case, including an arrest. But now we actually have more people that are believed to be involved in the abduction, the possible abduction. And, you know, we know that that police were actually looking for his remains in the yard that they were excavating for a week in November. So they believed that Michael's remains were in this yard. They charged the person who lived there, Sarah Wondra, with a failure to report Michael's death, and they excavated the yard, and we are now just learning that they did not find Michael's body in the yard, but they believe that his body was actually moved from the yard, and they have named two more people they believe are involved and have knowledge of what happened to Michael.
So, Alex, I know that Fruitland Police held a news conference yesterday. You were at it. So explain to us how they believe that Michael's remains were in that yard and that they were moved. And I guess the other question too, Alex, have law enforcement then said they believe that Michael is no longer alive?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, they believe that he is deceased. They were looking for his remains this whole time. They said in the press conference, so they actually named these two individuals that they believe have knowledge. One was named Brandon Shurtleff and the other is Adrian Lucien. And so what's interesting is that Brandon is thought to be somewhere in North Dakota and Adrian is thought to move between Ohio and California. So they're basically seeking information about these people and asking them to come forward and talk and speak with police. And, you know, like, it's really interesting because this is quite a huge development. This is the most that they've really released in a long period of time. And they believe that Michael's body was moved. I think because all the dogs that they brought in alerted, all the human remains dogs alerted on the yard. And they said that they detected anomalies in the yard with ground penetrating radar. So they believe that, you know, he was placed there, he was buried there, and then his body was moved somewhere else. And we also know that they conducted a search of a home in Cuna in connection with this as well, but we haven't heard any updates on that search. So, yeah, I think that this is quite a big update.
And Alex, my understanding too is, so it's these two other people that they are looking for. Sarah Wondra is behind bars with one charge. Her husband, is he also considered a person of interest? And I believe he's incarcerated on a different issue right now.
Yes, like all of these four people, Stacy, Sarah, Brandon, and Adrian, are all believed to have knowledge of what happened to Michael.
And they all lived in the house, right, when he went missing?
Yes, they were all crashing there, living there, renting there, living in the house when Michael went missing. And Stacy actually is in the Washington County Jail on unrelated charges. But Sarah is in the Payette County Jail on the charge of failure to report Michael's death. So, and a lot of people, sorry.
I was going to say, Alex, and my understanding too, is that police said that the reason why they went to this house, right, and that they did all of the digging that they did was that they had, and I believe the chief of police there said what, they had a very credible source from inside that house.
Yeah, he said that the credible tip, so he said that he had corroborating statements, no further detail than that Michael's remains could be found in the backyard, and that tip came from someone inside the home. And you know, it's one of the four people, but we don't know which one. And they won't say, because they're trying to protect the integrity of the investigation.
Okay. So at this point, Alex, what is then next in the investigation? Have they said anything about this house in CUNA, and have they searched that house yet, or are they going to?
So they said that there was a search conducted, but we don't know like the outcome. They also said in the press conference, there's additional evidence being processed from the searches they've been doing. So there could be something that comes of that. But Chief Huff said, we believe that more people than just these four have knowledge of what happened, and we will be seeking out those people. And he said that there will be further charges. So it's honestly kind of a waiting game at this point. I did talk to Chief Huff actually this morning, and he said, you know, investigators are still trying to catch their breath, but there's always more to do. Like they're not going to leave any stone unturned, essentially. They have to go through basically every tidbit of information that they have, so that if this case is brought to trial, then they have a solid one. So he believes, you know, there's still more work to be done. There's, you know, they still have to find Adrian and Brandon wherever they are. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how this case plays out, because I know that it is like, it pulls on a lot of people's heartstrings. I mean, it's a missing 5-year-old boy. So he hopes that, you know, there will be a conclusion, and he believes that there will be one eventually, but it just takes some time.
So Alex, I want to go back to something that you said just a moment ago. And that is that we know now that there are these four individuals who were in the home at the time of Michael's death. They're looking for two of them. Two of them are behind bars, but the chief of police believes there are even more people that know something.
Yes. And that's what's really weird about this case, is that so many people could possibly know what happened. And, you know, obviously he said charges are forthcoming. So he said we will be holding those people accountable. And, you know, and the interesting thing that he said to me is also like, your time for cooperation is up. Like, it's been a year and a half. You had a year and a half to come forward, and, you know, and there's still people harboring this information, not bringing it forward. You know, the time for cooperation is over.
Right.
And there's, you know, there's a family missing their kids. So.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, there is a family who for a year and a half basically has no idea where their child is. And I think all of our hearts go out to Michael's family. And you're right, Alex, the time for cooperation is up. So now, as you said, it is just a waiting game.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Alex, before we let you go, is there any new information in regards to the quadruple homicide up at the University of Idaho? I know you've also, you and other team members at KTVB have been covering this as well.
Also, I want to give a shout out to, you know, the other local news organizations and the local journalists, the student journalists there have been who have been covering it too at the Argonaut. They've been doing a really great job. I haven't been up there just recently, but it is I know that like the information that is coming out is kind of conflicting, and it's really, really hard to nail down what exactly is happening because the prosecutor did a couple interviews about how the house may have been targeted, may have not been targeted, and then backtracked. And then Moscow police later said that, you know, they believe that it was targeted and we don't know who was targeted. And, you know, so it's just really, really hard to kind of nail down the information. And I'm sure like Kevin can speak more on that, but it's just really hard because a lot of reporters are trying to get information. And you know, while you don't want to impede an investigation and release something that you probably shouldn't, you also just want to have the same information that everybody else does. So it's kind of been difficult. But yeah, so I mean, like that, we also know like Kaylee's dad said in the vigil that, you know, her and Madison were in the same bed together. Like they probably fell asleep on the same bed. And so that's kind of new information as well. But it doesn't really, you know, further anything more.
Kevin, I do want to stay with this for a little bit. And can we talk about what the university is doing or considering in terms of next semester, which starts in early January? Because they did allow students who did not feel comfortable to go remote, at least to the end of this semester. But I mean, that wraps up in a couple of weeks.
Right. I think to a large degree, what the University of Idaho is just trying to do is get through the next 2 weeks and get students through the next 2 weeks and get them wrapped up for fall semester in some manner that they feel comfortable with. But when I spoke to Tori Lawrence, the provost at U of I earlier this week, I asked, well, surely you have to be thinking about what might be coming down the road in spring. And he's like, yes, spring semester is only 6 weeks away. So they are talking about what their options might be, what scenarios might be. And I asked directly, does that mean that you might be offering more in the way of online learning options for students who still don't feel comfortable about being up at the campus? And he said that's on the table. And obviously so much can change. I mean, a lot can change in this investigation in 6 weeks. We don't know what the case is going to look like then. Nobody knows what this case is going to look like then. But clearly, the university's having to think about what their contingencies might be. Assuming that we get to second week of January and this case is more or less where it is right now.
So, Kevin, did you talk to them at all about how the number of students that that have decided to go remote for the remainder of the semester? And I ask that because I have not been able to find any numbers, but anecdotally, when you talk to students up there, or you talk to parents, or even faculty, everyone's saying about classes are about half full.
That's what I've read as well. You know, when I asked the provost about that, he said that his anecdotal accounting of it is a little bit more favorable than that. He thinks that there may be more students there, but nobody really knows for sure because the university isn't really taking a tally. They aren't really asking students to, you know, report in whether they're going to be in person or whether they're going to be off campus. They thought about doing a survey, but as he put it, we don't know. Students may decide to come up and then they may decide that they just don't feel comfortable. So instead of surveying them, we're just basically trying to serve them in some way. So nobody really knows for sure. But you know, definitely you've got fewer students on campus than you would have normally.
What about student retention, Kevin? I mean, is the University of Idaho concerned about that at all? I mean, I understand that the I mean, of course, the next semester doesn't start for 6 weeks, and anything can happen in those 6 weeks. But you know, I mean, I personally know parents who have kids up there. Some have stayed back, some went back to the university. But I'm wondering for those students who have chosen to stay home now, I can't see that changing come the spring semester if there's nothing happening in the investigation in regards to an arrest.
Yeah, I don't have the answer to that, but it's a really good question. You know, the way this fell in the middle of the semester, towards the end of the semester, students don't really have a whole lot of choice at this point, but to figure some way to round out the semester. You know, nobody's going to drop out in the middle of a semester, the final, you know, 3 or 4 weeks of the semester. But do students decide to take a gap semester? Do they decide just not to come back for spring semester and take some time off? I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know if anybody's got a handle on that, but that's definitely a number that we'll be chasing after come January. Mm-hmm. Is there going to be a drop off in enrollment?
Yeah. And then Kevin, I mean, you know, I know that you've talked with some students and other folks up in Moscow. And the one thing that we do know is that welfare checks are pretty high right now. As we go into 3 weeks.
Right. That was one of the numbers that the police department put out a few days ago. That the number of calls for welfare checks, number of calls to check on students or members of the community are up considerably. And that underscores what we already know, that there's a high level of fear and anxiety in that community.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that also goes back to the fact that it's you know, there's, as Alex said in our last segment, we get conflicting reports, right? I mean, it's that, you know, the very beginning, there's no threat. And then it was like, let's walk that back and say there possibly could be. And then even with this interview with the prosecuting attorney, you know, saying, well, there it was definitely targeted, and then saying, well, we're going to walk that back and say, well, we don't know if it was a person targeted or the residents targeted. I mean, there's just so much that I think that just causes extra anxiety.
And we continue to get those mixed signals. It's this kind of drip, drip, drip of new information, but not really new information, just sort of conflicting or confusing information. I mean, on Wednesday night, at 7:15 Wednesday night, right in the middle of the vigils, the Moscow Police Department put out a news release basically clarifying what, kind of walking back a little bit of what the Lake County prosecutor had said earlier in the week about whether this was a specifically targeted attack. Targeting one of the victims mm-hmm. in the house. So at the same time, you have the community coming together to mourn the loss of these four students. You have the police department coming back out with more information that seemingly contradicted or, you know, stood at odds with some of the other information that has come out. That feels like that kind of just sums up the case right now. That kind of sums up the situation in a nutshell. You've got mourning, but you've also got a great deal of confusion.
Absolutely. And Brian, I want to bring you into the conversation because your editorial board published an article really fairly critical of the communication coming from law enforcement around this investigation. And I think Kevin just hit the nail on the head, right? Is that it feels like there is constantly conflicting information coming out from investigators.
It does. There have been different dribs and drabs released by different individuals. There have been conflicting statements made to various, especially national media outlets. And that has a number of potential negative consequences, one of which, as Kevin discussed, is the unnecessary level of anxiety that's in the community. That comes from uncertainty about this. Actually, another issue, though, is that it's really important to have a very planned out set of information you release in a homicide like this, and a set of information that you hold back. What's usually called hold back information or single source information. Because if you eventually get a confession in the case, you want to have details that only the killer could know that they could tell you so that you can verify that their confession is genuine. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the mid-90s, another very publicized murder in Idaho, the murder of Angie Dodge.
I covered that.
I covered quite a bit the subsequent proceedings resulting in Chris Tapp's innocence. And a big factor in that case was that there were so many different dribs and drabs of information released, conflicting information, that Tapp was able to under pressure, construct a somewhat realistic sounding confession, even though he'd had nothing to do with it. And so that had very serious consequences. 20 years of an innocent man's life and a guilty man who escaped justice for 20 years.
And still a police department that won't say that they did anything wrong.
So there have been some updates in that. They finally settled the lawsuit in that case. But
yeah.
But as far as the control of information, that's something that's it really pays to have a deliberate strategy about. And it's somewhat understandable that some of these departments that are smaller, that don't have a lot of murders, much less have national media coming into town all the time, that they'd be a bit unprepared for this. But this is another time that should provide kind of a gut check to these local departments to come up with strategies for how you deal with communications, so you don't have the coroner saying one thing and the prosecutor another and the police chief another.
Well, and I think those are such good points, because we have all covered our fair share of homicide investigations, unfortunately. And I do think, Brian, one of the things that you wrote was when they first had that first news conference about 75 hours after the murders had happened, and when they had said that there was no threat, you know, walking that back, saying, well, you know, we don't have a suspect, there could be a threat. Everything that was said in that news conference really could have been said within 24 hours. And I think that that's in a way where some of the frustration started, right? Is that, and not just frustration from media. I mean, because I think, as you said, it's very important for people to know that police should not give out all of the information that they have, and they don't. And there's good reason why that is. I think what we're running into is it's conflicting information. It's walking information back. And from the get-go, if there had just been a blanket statement of saying, we are investigating, be vigilant, and we will give you information when it's necessary and needed, that would have had such a different tone than what continues to happen.
Yeah. The conflicting information, And the sort of lack of a comprehensive strategy by which it's released is the thing that's both frustrating for the public and for journalists, but also potentially damaging to the eventual case. And so it really speaks to the need to have a deliberate strategy about this, and to have a team in place who's making conscious decisions, not just letting slip new information in an interview on television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, because we all want this to be resolved and solved. I mean, for the families, for the victims, you know, the trauma that will remain for all of the students on campus. And so, we will have to see, I mean, I guess how more information is released or not released, because, I think, Alex mentioned this, you know, was that, you know, during the vigil, you know, Kaylee's dad gave out information that no one had known. And we've seen that happening a couple of times, Brian, is that the families, advertently or inadvertently, have given out new information. And then you wonder, well, is that information that police didn't want released? Or if they're telling it to the families, is it okay for the families to say something publicly? And we don't know.
Yeah, and that's the difficulty is the lack of what seems to be a comprehensive strategy around this. And so that's really what local cities should take note of, because there's nothing that prevents this from happening in another city. There will be another high profile crime like this somewhere in Idaho, and it pays to be prepared when it happens.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey, thanks for your patience and waiting. But I would love to know what in the world is going on in the case of the Satanic Temple lawsuit that is against the state of Idaho. This is in regards to an abortion law. So you've been on the program before talking about this. You've written about this before. But for folks who may be scratching their heads, fill us in on this.
Yeah, this is, the Satanic Temple files a lot of these lawsuits. And I think they kind of mm-hmm. see themselves as the arbiter for people who don't want to be part of traditional organized religion. And this is a way of trying to, use their position to talk about religious freedom in a different light. But they use some interesting legal arguments that are unusual. And
to say the least.
Yeah, when they filed this, I think it was early October when they filed this, they talked about how the abortion laws in Idaho, particularly the one that bans most abortions and the civil enforcement mechanism, I think they mentioned too, were unconstitutional violations of property rights and the Equal Protection Clause, as well as religious freedom and involuntary servitude. And so they kind of made a argument that your uterus is property because you can rent it out essentially as a surrogate to somebody if they wanted to have a child. And you can also sell your eggs for quite a bit of money on the market too. So that was an interesting one that I hadn't seen before. And they talked about how you have to supply a certain amount of your own body to grow a baby, essentially. And mm-hmm. so that's involuntary servitude if somebody's forcing you to provide those elements of your body. And so the state of Idaho has finally responded to it. They took a little while to develop their response. And they essentially said that it should be dismissed because, for one thing, a national organization like this can't sue a governor of a state under, I think it's the 11th Amendment. I think he has immunity from such lawsuits. That's what they're arguing. And mm-hmm. also that they said the involuntary servitude argument was, they didn't say offensive, but they basically said it was offensive to compare it to slavery. They said it was irrelevant because pregnancy is temporary. That was the property rights argument. But they said, the property interest is not relevant because it is temporary and it's not can't be dressed up as a property interest. And this is about protecting life. And they also said the servitude portion was legally indefensible and it's impertinent to what's going on because people aren't forced to have sex and get pregnant. And so it's not something that they should be able to argue. So we'll see if the court decides to dismiss it. They also said that the Satanic Temple should have like a named plaintiff or at least somebody who has already been subject to these laws and has been harmed by them, because at this point they are just saying this is on behalf of all of their members who ascribe to an abortion ritual that lets them have autonomy to their own bodies and things like that. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's a weird one. And it will be interesting to see if it is resolved before or after the Supreme Court comes out with its ruling, whenever that happens. I think that's part of why the state was waiting as long as it did to respond to this. I think they were wondering if the Supreme Court would put it out by now, mm-hmm. but they haven't. Well,
and you said, Kelsey, the Satanic Temple has filed a similar lawsuit. I know at least in Indiana, but like in other states as well.
Yeah, they actually have done this on a number of different topics. They have, I think I said in here, there were 8 lawsuits relating to things like religious monuments. Like they do a lot of lawsuits over things like the 10 Commandments being on a city property, things like starting a public meeting with prayer. And I don't know if they have launched any kind of lawsuit over, Idaho having In God We Trust above our legislative chambers, but it's those kind of things that they often go after. But they've definitely started with abortion lawsuits too in the last 6 months or so. I think they tried to intervene in a couple of Texas cases as well involving abortion. So they've been all over the place.
Yeah. And I mean, I can't remember who brought the lawsuit back. This was years ago. With the city of Boise having to remove a Ten Commandments monument from Julia Davis Park,
yeah,
and then they moved it onto private property. But You know, that was similar organizations coming out and saying this shouldn't be placed on city property.
Right. Yeah. It very well could have been them. I'm not sure who it was either.
I don't recall on that. I do recall covering that though. So Kevin, I'm sure you're not counting down the days, but maybe you are, but we're about a month away from the 2023 legislative session. So has Governor Little hinted at all at what he'd like to see happen during this next session?
Okay, well, first of all, we are more than a month away, so don't rush it, okay? It'll come soon enough. It'll be here soon enough. But yes, so Governor Little spoke for just a few minutes on Wednesday at the Associated Taxpayers of Idaho conference, and Kelsey was there all day. But ATI is this group that most lay people don't really care about, and every year, their annual conference is sort of the unofficial run-up to the legislative session. And in this case, the governor spoke a little bit about, mostly about what has been done over the past 4 years. It was kind of rattling off some of his accomplishments from first term, from getting through the pandemic and mm-hmm. you know, managing the pandemic and managing to continue to build up budget surpluses through the pandemic, on through September and the special session and the $410 million that was put into education and the $500 million in tax cuts. So he kind of hinted that he wants to see more of the same. I mean, I think come next month, come January 9th, when the governor delivers his State of the State address, I would imagine that we're going to hear a lot of the same kind of themes that we've heard over the past 4 years and kind of the same themes that he touched on Wednesday, that he's going to want to continue to look at more tax relief, more investments in education, more money into infrastructure. I mean, those are kind of his, three-legged stool in terms of public policy right now. So I wouldn't expect a whole lot of difference come January 9th.
Oh, okay. So January 9th. So Kevin, it's really only like 5 weeks.
Okay, fine. But that's still, 5 weeks is still more than a month.
That's true. That's true. Because we know where you'll be come January.
I know all our way through.
Exactly right. So, Brian, you recently wrote an article about your thoughts on Idaho needing an anti-SLAPP law. So that doesn't mean you hit somebody. But can you first tell us what that stands for and then why you think this is necessary?
Sure. So SLAPP, spelled with two P's, stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. And it's a phenomenon where often somebody who is wealthy, who has money to spend on lawyers, will file a frivolous or meritless lawsuit, usually a defamation lawsuit, against somebody who is critical of them or of something they're doing. And the objective in many of these cases is not actually to win the lawsuit, because it's a meritless lawsuit. The objective is to draw out the legal process and cause the person, the speaker, to have to spend a whole lot of money on lawyers through the discovery process and other very expensive parts of the court process. And in many cases, just the burdens of that are sufficient to chill free speech, prevent somebody from engaging in speech that they worry could be subject to a SLAPP law, a SLAPP lawsuit. Now, anti-SLAPP laws provide sort of an escape valve for these. They allow judges early on to make a ruling about whether there is any credible basis for a lawsuit. And depending on the state, they sometimes impose penalties for even trying to pursue it. So sometimes these are what are called treble damages. It'll be three times the court costs and attorney fees that the defendant went incurred. The plaintiff will have to pay them.
And you were in the article that you wrote, you were talking about a lawsuit that was filed by Clearwater Analytics co-founder, right? And him suing several people who spoke out against what some conditional use permits on his property.
Yes, that's right. So Michael Boren has been, he owns a ranch in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area, and he's been suing some people who opposed a conditional use permit that he applied for. I'm not making the assertion that this is a SLAPP law, though, or a SLAPP lawsuit, but that possibility was raised by the judge in the case, even though Idaho does not have a SLAPP law.
Okay, interesting. Okay. So, Kelsey, can you fill us in? Apparently, there's been a tort claim that's been brought against the city of Boise, as well as Boise police, over some abortion protests back in the spring?
Yeah, these are two separate tort claims, actually. This arising from the same protest, and they're both against Boise police and the city. They also name like 20 or so specific officers who are all ordered to, you know, preserve evidence that is related to these incidents. The tort claims, if for anybody who's not familiar, are supposed to be filed to give notice to a government entity that a lawsuit is pending, or will soon be filed within 180 days of the event that is in question. And so they actually filed this like exactly 180 days from when this happened, which was May 14th. It was about a week or so, maybe closer to 2 weeks after the Supreme Court opinion that would overturn Roe. The draft opinion was leaked. And a lot of people came out to downtown Boise and were protesting that happening, including one non-binary person named Kimra Luna and their two young children. Kimra has been a pretty active pro-choice activist for a long time, it sounds like, and had a megaphone that was out there shouting abortion, keep abortion legal and keep abortion safe, just kind of marching through the streets doing those things. Mm-hmm. And it's, according to the tort claim, the Boise police tried to seize the megaphone and take it away from them, and used violent force, quote unquote, to confiscate it and then arrested and jailed Luna in front of their children. And so the police charged them with misdemeanor, resisting and obstructing law enforcement, and with some kind of noise disturbance charge. And both of those were dismissed. But there is still a lot of harm that Luna says was done emotionally and as far as their civil rights being violated, as their right to protest in a public square. And there were a lot of other people too who were using megaphones at various protests. And so Luna says that they were targeted for their gender identity and for being Mexican American. And so there's those claims as well. The other person who filed the tort claim was Christy Jordan, a Meridian resident who was also there with her son. They're both represented by somebody from the same firm, but it sounds like they're not super connected in any other ways. She says that she was, you know, trying to just be on the street with her son and protest, and the police told her to move, and she did not. And she says she was not obstructing traffic in any way, not impeding any kind of safety, but they charged her with a felony for a battery on law enforcement officers and a misdemeanor charge of, I think, obstructing, and also an infraction for jaywalking, which seems excessive, but there were lots of other people crossing the street outside of sidewalks. And so she says she was targeted as well. And that misdemeanor, or the felony charge and the infraction against her, were dismissed, but the misdemeanor is still pending in court. I'm not sure why that is, but, you know, she claims the same things about emotional distress and false imprisonment and violation of constitutional rights and all those sorts of things. And it comes at a kind of an awkward time for Boise police, because they've just had this investigation going on about their former captain, I think it was, that came out as a white supremacist, and he's been on that force for 20 years, or he was on that force for 20 years. And so it's kind of keeping with an unfortunate theme for them right now, potentially with some of these claims.
Yeah, I think you bring up a very good point with that and how that will then be looked at and frankly investigated as we know, the city of Boise came out this week saying that they will do a thorough investigation with the in regards to this former captain. So this may be one of the cases that they look at. Kevin, the Nampa School District, man, they're hoping to get a $2 million bond passed, right? And this is about aging buildings, correct?
Yeah, this is $210 million that they're seeking. It is one of the larger
$210 million.
Yeah, $210 million for a laundry list of building needs, new facilities, building repairs. It's one of the larger bond issues we've seen in recent memory. I mean, you know, we had one in November that was a $250 million bond issue in Idaho Falls, which failed.
Yeah.
This is a big request, and it feels like this is sort of the trend that we're seeing now. Districts with some really big facilities needs coming before voters with large bond issues. This will be on the ballot in March, and it all coincides, Gemma, with the legislative session and what I expect will be quite a bit of discussion at the State House about, does the state need to take on a more active role, a more assertive role in helping pay for school facilities? Because right now, if you're a school district like Nampa or Idaho Falls or West Ada, if you're listening in the West Ada district, yeah, righty, there's probably going to be a bond issue coming your way in the not too distant future, CUNA as well. The only way for these school districts to really build schools, the only real funding source that they have that provides big money for buildings is through local property taxes. So they have to go mm-hmm. to voters, take a bond issue, get a two-thirds majority to get a bond issue passed. That is a tough thing to do. We'll be watching this Nampa bond issue really closely. We'll also be watching really closely to see what comes down the pike in West Ada and CUNA and what comes down the pike in the legislature in terms of whether the state steps in on funding school buildings.
Funding school buildings, because, I mean, these are aging buildings. I mean, no one can disagree with that.
Right. And I think when people hear us talking about school funding, and we talk about, the $410 million of K-12 money or education money that was allocated in the special session, none of that really addresses buildings. A lot of it will probably wind up addressing teacher salaries. It may address benefits for employees, a lot of those human resources costs. It really does not address school buildings. That's all paid for at the local level.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for coming on today. Really appreciate your time and your thoughts. We've been talking with Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, and Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. And Alex Duggan joined us at the beginning of the segment with KTVB. As always, thank you all. And make sure that you check out all of their reporting as well. So happy Friday. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Experiencing the news each day can feel like a journey. With Up First from NPR, it doesn't have to be. Welcome to 15 easy minutes of breaking news, clarity on international and national affairs, all handed over not from some floating voice in the sky, from us, Layla, A, Steve, and me, Rachel. Start your day informed. Subscribe to Up First wherever you get your podcasts.